I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
Hello and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast where two guys get together. We talk about horror movies, science fiction movies, sometimes television series, sometimes literature, sometimes all kinds of stuff. And we ramble all over the place. Why? Because we are unscripted. We are just, sometimes we don't even know what we're going to say ourselves, let alone what we're going to say to each other. But we try to look at the topic of the week and the key influences that contributed to that particular piece of media, and then things that it influenced going forward in time as we speak. We've been doing it for quite a long time. If you're new to us, we'd love to find out how you found out about us. Let us know down in the comments. Just say, hey, a friend recommended you, or, oh, I just found you guys online, or, oh, I thought Tim was so handsome, or whatever. You know, just let us know down below. Well, if you're returning, then obviously you already know that Tim is handsome, and that's why you're back. And we're glad to have you here. My name's David, here with my good friend Tim. Tim, we're back again at it. What have you been doing this week?
Oh my gosh, it's February 2nd, and I feel so handsome.
It's almost Valentine's Day, so you should be, you know.
Oh my goodness. I am doing well. We usually start this rodeo with what we've done in our genre week for the past week or so.
Yep.
And I watched a little ditty in the horror genre called The Wolfman, or just Wolfman. I thought this would tie in really well with today's topic, since it is a universal film. And I had a lot I wanted. I had a little bit riding on this movie. I was really wanting this movie to be great, and it's not. Have you seen it?
No.
Okay. I did like it. There are just things about it that nag at me, so I can understand why others have a lot of frustration with it. Mm-hmm. It's directed by Lee Whannell. You know, Lee Whannell did the Invisible Man Invisible reboot, Man, which I really loved.
Yeah.
So I was hoping for better things with this. It was co-written by his wife, Corbett Tuck. She's a frequent collaborator of his. And as we know from doing The Conjuring a few seasons back, he's good friends with James Wan. They kind of started things together, I think, in Australia. The cast is strong. The cast is the best part about this. It's got Christopher Abbott, who we last saw as the stranger in It Comes at Night.
Mm.
He's the one whose wife and child join the the family. It's a post-apocalyptic thing. If you haven't seen it, go back and watch our episode, folks.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And it also stars Julia Garner, who is a favorite of mine ever since Ozark. She is the blonde young actress from Ozark. Synopsis is Blake and his family are attacked by an unseen animal and in a desperate escape barricade themselves inside a farmhouse as the creature prowls the perimeter. As the night stretches on, however, Blake begins to behave strangely, transforming into something unrecognizable that soon jeopardizes his wife and daughter. So there are elements of the original Wolfman in it as far as the whole tragedy of the thing. You know, the fact that his, you know, it's not Lon Chaney Jr. and his girlfriend. It is a man and his wife.
Okay.
And it is, well, I don't want to give too much away, but they kind of do a backstory about the guy's father and being from that area of the United States, which was in the Northwest, like Washington, Oregon, whatever.
Of course.
This movie only gets 48% on Rotten Tomatoes with 276 reviews. I say it's better than that. I would give it a 75. It just needed a rewrite. The main story takes place in one night, and it should have stretched over a few days to fully flesh out the characters.
Of course.
I think maybe it was rushed. I don't know. I love the setting. I love that they tie Native American folklore into it, which, you know, the other one was set in Europe, if I'm not mistaken, the original.
Of course.
They probably could have even had, like, a Native American character, but they don't. There's nothing. They just briefly mention it. And lastly, the worst thing about it is that the makeup is more man than wolf, which I know it's called Wolf Man, but they could have done better with that, especially when you've got all these other modern movies. Well, I say modern, but American Werewolf in London came out, 40 years ago, and the makeup in that was just phenomenal.
Oh, gosh,
and yeah. So whenever you see a Wolfman or a werewolf movie, you expect to see really good makeup, and the makeup is just not that great. What else? They toss out some of the legends like Silver Bullets and Full Moons, which I don't have a problem with. And like I said, the best thing is they do try to get the tragedy of the story, which to me is what it makes the original Universal Pictures so memorable. So I love that. There's also some really good nighttime photography.
Interesting, because Lee Whannell is one of my favorite interviews on Flanagan's podcast. That's a really good episode. And he seems like he really knows his horror and his literature. So that's sad. And we both talked about Invisible Man and how much we liked it. And
God, that's a great movie.
Yeah, it was a very good adapt and a very good push towards it. Maybe it was rushed. Maybe they were saying, hey, we got to get it out because Frankenstein's coming out with Guillermo, we got to get in there or whatever.
I'm telling you, they should have let it simmer. I think it could have been really, really good. It just wasn't quite there.
Well, that's sad. Well,
that's what I did.
For my genre, it's not our typicals. It's sort of an offshoot. You know, we've kind of expanded a little bit and do more fantasy and or suspense or mystery. This is more of an action thriller, and I had to watch it because I'm working with a client and the theme of their upcoming event was Mission Impossible. So I had to catch up, and I guarantee you haven't seen either of these final two movies. Because you are such a Tom Cruise fan, but
love him.
I had to watch
Not.
Dead Reckoning, which when it came out in 23 was called Dead Reckoning Part 1. And then they came out with the last one, the sequel to it, the second part of it. And instead of being called Dead Reckoning Part 2, it was called Final Reckoning. So, but it's all of the motifs that make Mission Impossible movies what Mission Impossible movies have been since Tom Cruise started them, which are always suspect the people that send you on the mission. They're always going to be double agents, or they're going to track you, or there's something bad. Some really good, you know, we always talk about casting. I do like his team that he always gets together, meaning Simon Pegg, who's the big computer wizard, Ving Rhames, who is another computer wizard, but also just a great philosopher. You know, he's got all those big Ving Rhames quotes and stuff that he has. This time they're joined by Haley Atwell, who is a pickpocket that joins the team and becomes a, not really a love interest for Ethan Hunt, but definitely a person of interest in it. You've got a lot of homages back. Did I like either one of them? No. Are the stunts really good? Yes. Amazing stunts sort of thing. But it's like you. It needed a rewrite. It needed work. They were trying to do stuff that they couldn't do. They were trying to tell this final story of Ethan and bring in all of the past movies and all the things he's done to, quote, save the world, but also the guilt factors of people that he's lost and team members that have died and sacrifices that he's made and da-da-da. But we can't stop to really talk about that because the next action sequence is coming and he's got to jump off a plane or jump, you know, fall off a helicopter and parachute onto a train, which he literally does.
Literally does.
And again, my big thing about all the Mission Impossibles, because I've seen them all now, is it's such an uncanny sort of mix of physics and practical stunts and totally ludicrous physics that make no sense and would never happen. Either the way it's filmed or the way it's shot or the way it's paced. You know, you have a chase scene that if it was 4 minutes long would have been really good. At 11 minutes long, it gets really old, really fast sort of thing. And it suffers from JJ-isms, which is, you know, we've got this magic box. We don't know what it is, but here it is. And this is the MacGuffin that we'll have to find out later. And it either never works into the plot or it's so unconventional, doesn't matter, you know, or non-consequential sort of thing. So anyway, and then it's just action scene after action scene after action scene. So,
you know what? I mean, it's clearly a popular type of movie now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what its equivalent would have been like 40 years ago.
James Bond.
Would have been like, well, James Bond would have, yeah, I could see what you're, that James Bond would more closely fit, but I'm talking as far as sensational stunt. And I'm thinking the only thing I can think of is like the car chase movies of the 70s.
Yeah.
Bullet. And stuff where they were always trying to do like spectacular car crash stunt type stuff.
Even so much so that it spilled into Dukes of Hazzard on television sort of thing.
Right. I'm thinking
Smokey and the Bandit.
I guess I'm – look at me trying to apply keys to your topic.
It's what we do.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was – it is – it's immensely popular. I'll be curious if this really is the end of the franchise because it did make money in 25, so it was popular. So we'll have to wait and see. I don't know.
Maybe they'll recast it.
Yeah. Well, he's in his, what, 60s, right? Yeah. And he is.
Shia LaBeouf is Tom Cruise.
Oh, my gosh. Well, and this one even gets so bad because they're basically chasing an AI. And so the entire two movies are about an AI. And it just gets, like I said, it gets totally ludicrous. If you're going to give it that much power, then it's got that much power. You can't just then put it to sleep like the Borg or whatever. You got to do something with it. So, anyway, that's what I did. You went Wolfman hunting and classic Universal monster, and I went to modern action adventure thriller sort of thing.
Well, and I guess these movies could also be considered action and adventure of their time.
Yeah.
There's certainly a deformed character like Tom Cruise. No, just kidding. And I would actually closely relate the fact that I mentioned The Wolfman as being a Universal movie. The first of this double feature, folks, we're doing The Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, wait.
The 1920.
Pause right there. I just got a thing that said you only have 5 minutes left. That's why I don't do it that way. Let's end this meeting. I'll call you right back and we'll start right where you transition.
Yeah, because I'll need that stuff.
Okay. Oh, yeah. We need all that. So I'm going to stop recording and I'm going to end it and leave your Audacity going and I'll send you a new invite.
Okay.
Still recording. Yeah.
All right.
Ta-da, we're back. Make sure you got all your photos. You obviously do, I guess.
Oh, I don't know, but you'll have to hit record.
Oh, damn.
All right, you ready?
That's more like it. Yeah.
Today we are talking, well, today we have a double feature featuring the movies, the 1925 version of The Phantom of the Opera, the silent version, the Universal picture, and then we're going to jump ahead a few years to 1962's Hammer version of The Phantom of the Opera. There have been a lot of Phantom of the Operas, but we picked these two. And, well, for obviously good reasons, I think we wanted to get the Universal versus the Hammer, because those two were always, well, Hammer was always redoing Universal movie monsters. However, the 1925 one, I feel, is probably the more iconic one and the one that most people will associate with the image, unless you're just a big Andrew Lloyd Webber fan. In the 1925 one, I've got a little bit of a synopsis here. Aspiring young opera singer Christine Daae, is that how you say that?
Daae, yep.
Yeah, okay. Discovers that she has a mysterious admirer intent on helping her become a lead performer. This enigmatic masked presence is Eric, also known as the Phantom, a horribly disfigured recluse who lives under the Paris Opera House. Mm-hmm. When the Phantom takes Christine prisoner and demands her devotion and affection, her suitor, Vicomte Raoul de Chagny, who wolves refer to as Raoul, sets out to rescue her. I've got such a history with this movie, even though I really didn't watch it until a few years ago.
That
sounds really strange. I've often mentioned that I had a book called The Illustrated History of Horror Movies that I got as a kid when I was in like the 1970s, big book, and it had pictures in it, and there was a picture of the Phantom of the Opera that just terrified me. I just thought it was the scariest thing I'd ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. I was the kid that would be running down the hall, you know, gotta run, the Phantom of the Opera's after me, that kind of thing. I was, and you would have to say, the Phantom of the Opera, because there's no way. I mean, I guess I would have, you could call him the Phantom, but back then I wouldn't have known better. And then eventually, about 2 years, maybe three, I finally sat down and watched the silent version. And I was really impressed. I was like, this kind of blows me away. Then I mentioned to you a few, maybe last season, that I'd watched Lon Chaney documentary, mm-hmm. where it was a very strange documentary because the beginning of the movie and started with like the last 20 minutes of this movie, The Phantom of the Opera, 1925. And I was like, am I watching a documentary? Why am I watching the end of this movie again? And then, of course, I watched it again the other night for this, and I have nothing but high praise for it. I think out of all the Phantom of the Opera movies that have come out, I still think this is probably the best one.
Yes, so. I would. Yes, I think the most. It's interesting. I think we both have an elevated background with this particular topic. Mm-hmm. It is a double feature, and I watched the 25, and I watched the 65? Is that the Hammer?
It's 62. 62 Hammer.
I also, unfortunately, watched the 43 Claude Rains version as well. And I am a huge Andrew Lloyd Webber Family Opera fan. It was the first play I ever saw on Broadway, so naturally I have a thing with it. But I also have a history from the past, too. I had all of the models, all of the, you know, the Creature from the Black Lagoon. And you had, you know, this for the Phantom. It was that typical pose that he had when he's unmasked and turns around to face her and everything. And,
right.
And that's,
I had that model too.
And it glowed and in the dark.
Some had glow in the dark hands. I think he had a glow in the dark hand.
Yeah. And the mask glowed too. But yes, I think. All that being said, so I had seen all of these versions, though, back in the 70s and 80s. I had seen the Herbert Lom version. I'd seen the Claude Rains version. I'd seen the silent one. And I've even seen the movie adaptation of the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical with Gerard Butler. So
I thought it was Antonio Banderas. Is it?
He's in another version of Phantom.
Oh, yes. Wow. I haven't seen either of those.
Both of them are pretty good adepts. All of them have the aesthetic of LaRue's original story. So I think all of them work. They just take liberties in different ways. I think the Claude Rains one, to me, especially watching them so close together, all three of them back to back almost, That's Claude Rains one is really the most flawed one because they go so much for the humor in it. They go to, I won't talk about it a lot because there's a lot of humor. You know, they create a love triangle sort of thing. In the classic story, it's Raoul trying to be the hero and save Christine from the Phantom. And the Phantom's obsessed with her. And whether he's in love with her or not doesn't matter. He's obsessed with her. That's the gag. But in the Claude Rains version, they also throw in another inspector. And now there's a love triangle trying to get Christine in the above ground world, in addition to the Phantom, who's in love with her. And it got convoluted. I do think the 25 version is the closest to the novel. I do think it's the best with the scares.
Well, that was going to be my question. I've never read the novel, so I'm not really certain what is the closest of everything. There's so many properties out there.
Yeah, I think it's...
Even Dario Argento has one.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Well, it's... Yeah. I think it makes horror directors and horror writers, I think it's a classic story. It's that, especially, well, okay, one thing I did find in research, because I haven't read this story since the 70s sort of thing, but I did, in recap, look at it, and in the original story, he is a villain. He is a bad guy. He kills people at the opera. He kills patrons. He does anything he can to get Christine to make her become a star kind of thing. And Chaney did that and is scary and is manipulative and is dangerous in the 25 film. But there's also the way he plays him. There's this pathos to him. And you kind of feel sorry for this creature that is living under the opera house and all of this. And that's played up in several other versions through the decades, I think. So I think it's something that writers and directors like to tap into, that whole kind of cursed villain sort of thing who wouldn't be as bad if people hadn't been mean to him kind of thing.
Well, it's a universal monster thing.
Yeah.
It's the same with Frankenstein. It's the same with Wolfman. It's not with all of them. I would not say it's with the Invisible Man or with Dracula, but it's definitely with Wolfman and Frankenstein.
And Creature.
And to a slight degree, Creature. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's...
They're a victim of circumstance.
And it's even in the musical. The musical does go back to... So one of the things that I like that is original to the Hammer version, and maybe we'll jumble these up. I don't know how we're going to talk about them without talking about them compared, I guess, is they change the whole thing and make him a totally different character. His name isn't even Eric. It's Petrie or whatever, the professor. They call him the professor in the Hammer version. And he is deformed himself because of an accident with acid. And in the original novel and in the original movie, the 25, and in the Lloyd Webber play, he's born this way. His mother even didn't like him and made him wear a mask even when he was a small child. So there's, again, that pathetic kind of feel for the Phantom. And he was born this way. And
does it say that in this movie?
Yeah, in 25, they talk about he's always had a mask. He's always worn a mask.
But he escaped from Devil's Island.
Yes.
He was a berserk criminal or whatever.
Yeah, well, criminally insane, I think is what they call him, in the little card that he hands the inspector. Yeah.
Right. Right. So maybe he went insane because he was deformed and ridiculed. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But the whole thing of a masked mentor who is he in love with you or not doesn't matter, but he wants you to be your best and to achieve your art, to be the greatest star you've ever been, you know, is a great subtext to this whole story. It's a Svengali sort of thing. That's one of my keys, is it's very Svengali sort of, you know, thematic to it.
Hmm.
But
you want to talk scenes?
Yeah. Do you remember the first time you ever saw this version of 25? You said it was just a few years ago, right?
I think I have always seen clips from it. Obviously, the iconic clips that scare the shit out of you. Yeah. But I had never watched it in its entirety until it was about, I want to say it was 2 or 3 years ago. I was watching it late one night off Turner Classic. And then, like I said, I ended up having to watch the ending of it again when I watched that documentary. Then I watched it again a couple of nights ago. And I think it's, to me, we've covered a few silent films on this show. We've covered Metropolis. We've covered Nosferatu. Mm-hmm. To me, this one is probably the best of the silent films I know of. I would probably put Nosferatu second, even though it's a little funny in places.
Yeah, like I think
when
you're
carrying his casket around.
I would always go toward Charlie Chaplin for best silent movies ever made. But if you're horror silence, I do think this one's the best.
Yeah,
and I do think it's better
definitely
than Nosferatu. And like I think I even told you offline, I even watched two different versions of the 25 that had totally different soundtracks because of the re-edits that they've done and everything else. But I guess for scenes, when I think of Phantom, the scenes that I always think of, no matter the version, is, of course, the mask reveal. Christine actually, you know, taking his mask off, even though he told her not to. And you see the Phantom for the first time. Prior to that, probably the masquerade ball, because putting him in the Mask of the Red Death sort of costume with the skeleton face and the royal robes and all that is so cool. Those are, I think those
especially when they tint it red.
Yeah, in the re-release, yeah, the 29 version.
In the,
yeah. I think those are two classic moments in it that kind of go all the way through a lot of the different versions. It's definitely in the Lloyd Webber. It is not in the Herbert Lom one, just because they change some things in it.
They changed a lot in the Herbert Lom one. It became kind of a vengeance story.
Well, yeah, well,
we'll
get
to that.
Yeah, it's much more of I think the other versions are much more of a Christine story. She's really the protagonist. Whereas the Herbert Lom one, it's very much he's the protagonist. From the very first, from the credits, a close-up of his eye, you know.
It's just his face for the entire credits. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
And I think, he becomes much more the protagonist in it. So
I agree.
What else? Other scenes?
Well, you mentioned that probably the two best scenes. I would also, for some reason, the scene always sticks into my head when he's got the two guys trapped in the floor with the, it's like explosives, and you're thinking he's going to blow them up, but in actuality, he floods them.
Yeah.
And at one point, he like turns up the heat too, and they get really hot. And like
that's in a different
several
room. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But there's several instances in this that are a little bit wonky, and it's the fact that Christine can always talk him out of killing people.
Yep.
She could say, "I will love you if you let them go," and he does. I know the last scene is also really good too. When the mob is on him right at the river, and he acts like he's got a hand grenade or something, and he lifts it up like he's going to kill them, and then he just laughs and opens it, and there's nothing in it, and they all attack him and throw him into the river.
Yeah, they kill him. Yeah,
yeah, that scene sticks out too.
It's interesting. The choices that the different versions want to make all through history of, is the Phantom killed or does he just disappear? Because in the Lloyd Webber version, he just vanishes. He allows Christine to leave and he just vanishes. In the Claude Rains version, he gets away at the very end. You just kind of see his mask left behind as he gets away. In the Herbert Lom one, he dies. In this one, the mob kills him. So, yeah. I do think, again, another scene I think I would mention that is in a lot of the versions is the, you know, just the catacombs themselves and underneath the opera house, and the fact that there's a lake or a river or something running underneath that he gets in a boat and transports Christine that way, sort of thing. So,
yeah, I think that's another reason why it's an iconic movie, is the fact that he lives in the sewers. And when I was a kid walking to school, I was always looking in sewers thinking I was going to see the Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, nowadays people think they're going to see Pennywise.
Yep.
But I always thought the Phantom of the Opera.
Yep.
Before we move on, I forgot to do a little bit of background. This movie was directed by Rupert Julian, but it was uncredited by three other directors, Lon Chaney, Ernst Lamel, I can't say that,
Lemley?
And Edward Sedgwick.
Yeah.
Lemley? Is that how you say it? Okay. Yep. And Edward Sedgwick. There was a lot of this going on, especially in movies from like the 39 going back. I know that like Gone with the Wind had a lot of directors.
Yep.
And I'm not sure what the reason is for that. I know Lon Chaney probably had his foot in a lot because he, you know, was the mastermind behind the makeup and the creature himself. I don't really know much about these people because, well, this movie's 100 years old.
It is literally 100 years old in 25. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I know from production that, and in my production notes, that Carl Lemley actually met Gaston Leroux and commissioned the rights to tell his novel. And so he went back. Chaney really loved it.
You mean Ernst Lemley?
Yeah.
Ernst?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, Carl. I think it's his brother. Carl.
Oh,
Lemley.
So they're related.
And
okay.
He's the producer. He's also the producer. I'm pretty sure he's the producer of Creature from the Black Lagoon, too. Oh. Pretty sure.
Wouldn't be surprised if he's still working for Universal.
Yeah, but anyway, so he had the rights. He gave them to, or showed them to, of course, Chaney, who loved the project and wanted to do it and everything else. And at that time, as film was emerging, personalities sold movies. You went to see a Clark Gable picture. You know, you went to see a Charlie Chaplin movie. So these personalities, right. These stars had already started rising up. And from what I read, Julian was a terrible director. He was just really bad. And Chaney hated him so much so that Chaney, after only like a week of photography, refused to even speak to him. They had to have a translator.
Have a translator talk
in between them. And Julian ended up leaving like 3 weeks before the film was finished shooting. So
wow.
Obviously, it was very contentious between them, and they had to bring in other directors. And Chaney, of course, had some of that directing credit because he, you know, kind of directed himself with what the makeup would look best in and everything else. So,
and maybe even the unmasking scene or something.
Yeah.
Like what angle?
How I want to shoot this. How you want to do this. This is where I'm going to be standing. Put the camera over there. You know, yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned Gaston, you say LaRue, I say LaRoe.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Either one.
Let's call the whole thing off.
Yeah.
I have that Gaston died 2 years after the film's premiere. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
So he actually got to see it, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it also had 8 uncredited writers. So there's a lot of writing going on behind the scenes of this movie as well as direction.
Well, and I think that's why it kind of flows kind of disjointedly. We cut in between all the cast talking backstage, and then suddenly we're back on stage watching an opera, and then we're suddenly in the catacombs. You know, so, yeah.
Yeah, it does jump around a bit. But then again, a lot of silent films did that. You mentioned having seen 2 different versions when we were doing research for this. In 1953, the film entered public domain because Universal forgot to renew its copyright registration 28 years later. That really kind of blows my mind. So you've got it's public domain. I could have seen it easily any time since I was born, but I didn't see it until a few years ago. That's very strange.
So. Well, there's lots of great trivia and stuff about this version. Of course, you've got Lon Chaney, known as the Man of 1,000 Faces. He brutalized himself for makeup for both this and Hunchback. So, and for other movies as well. But
The Unholy Three, he was in drag.
Yeah. They They constructed Soundstage 28 for this, specifically for this film. It stayed until 2014. It was still a Universal Soundstage until it was torn down in 2014.
Right, and they were using it for a lot of stuff. I can't remember what some of the things were.
Jurassic Park, Psycho, all of those were filmed in Soundstage 28. So, and it just had such an influence on Universal in general. Just all the monster movies, of course, were influenced by this. The whole German expressionism sort of thing that is in this, you know, all these vaulted, huge, great big sets and all these weird angles of staircases and shadow and stuff. Very German expressionism sort of thing. I've got in trivia, the reveal is considered one of the scariest moments in history at the time. So the mask reveal, the makeup reveal was considered one of the scariest moments in history.
Well, and it was also because Chaney, and we didn't talk cast, we can talk a little bit about it because we're not going to know much.
Sure.
But Chaney kept it a secret from the cast until it was revealed in the shot. And then the entire production kept it secret from the world until it premiered in a theater because they didn't have television show commercials on or anything.
No.
You did not know what he was going to look like till you were sitting in that theater. And had I been a little kid in 1925, I would have run screaming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The theater. I guarantee it.
And you mentioned different versions. Like I said, I watched two just, Googling on Amazon and found two different versions of two different soundtracks, one really good and one really bad. But we even now, even with all the historians and the restoration and everything else, don't have the exact version that came out in 25 because a lot of film was lost, along with another one called London After Midnight, which I've never seen that movie.
Right.
Have you seen that movie?
No, no one has because it's been missing forever.
It was
a very famous vampire film that Chaney did.
It was destroyed in the Universal fire when the vault fire happened. I didn't know that because I knew that a lot of silent movies even were destroyed, but also some of the cuts and scenes of this film were destroyed in that fire. So you couldn't have the same version.
Yeah, I know a little bit about London After Midnight because I've always been fascinated with that movie.
Yeah.
There's pictures of Chaney's makeup, which is phenomenal in it as well. They remade it. It's a little controversial because he looks like he's a vampire, and then you find out at the end of the movie that he's hired to play a vampire and scare people.
Ah,
and they remade it as a movie, and I cannot remember the name of it. But it's with Bela Lugosi and someone else, of course. And they end up, it's the only Bela Lugosi vampire movie where he actually is not a vampire at the end. So they did remake it into a talkie. It's like Curse of the Vampire, I think, or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's not that great a movie, which kind of makes me really want to see London After Midnight even more. I keep hoping it'll turn up. And have for like 40 years.
Yeah.
Been wanting it to turn up.
Somewhere. Somebody has it somewhere. Yeah.
Right. But before we keep going, since we're on Chaney, we can talk about him a little bit.
Yeah.
He is obviously the star of the movie. I mentioned him in a documentary I saw not too long ago that Kenneth Branagh narrated. Phenomenal makeup artist. Well, just all around Renaissance man.
Yeah.
Because I can't think of very many people at that time that were known by name. He's one. Valentino was one. I'm sure there's a female, like maybe Pickford.
Mary Pickford. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. There were just, yes. And Charlie Chaplin, of course.
Yep.
But Chaney was up there. He was a power player in Hollywood at that time because he was so good at what he did. He was a good actor. He was a good makeup artist. He was a good stuntman.
Yep.
Too.
I think between him and Charlie Chaplin, they really set the standard for what film acting was. This was a new medium. This was a new means of communication. But each of them were so talented in what they did that they kind of set the standard of this is what, especially for silent films, this is what movie acting is all about, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, bring the pathos and don't just make it scary or funny, but make it sad as well.
Yeah. And
drama.
and Chaney came from vaudeville because his parents mm-hmm. were in vaudeville. And mm-hmm. so he came.
And they were.
Go ahead.
You got, I was going to say they were deaf. Both yes. were deaf.
Yes. So that elevated his body to communicate more.
To pantomime.
And so yeah. that worked very well, I think, for him being able to play the pathos and being able to play these moments where he goes from angry to sad to scared to, you know, manipulative, all of that, all without any form of dialogue. That's great.
Right. Right. So, yeah. If you for any of you folks out there that have not seen A Man, The Man with, is it The Man of a Thousand Faces
yeah.
or just Man of a Thousand Faces? It is a like 50s movie, I think, 40s or 50s with Jimmy Cagney in it. And he played, it's a biopic on Lon Chaney. And that's how I knew his parents were deaf, because they're deaf in that movie.
Yeah.
Anything else about Chaney you want to say?
I have in my notes the same thing you said. He kept the reveal hidden, even from the kind of a good bridge for you, the actress. She had never seen the makeup until the reveal, because right. he wanted a genuine reaction from her. So,
right. And there was, I read some trivia somewhere where he asked for some co-star, not a woman, it was a man. It may not even been a co-star. It may have been some part of the crew. He asked them to come to his dressing room. And when they opened the door, he turned around in full makeup and the guy screamed. And he's like, that's all I need.
That's all I needed. Thanks. Yep.
That was great. I read a little bit more about him. I won't go too deep into it, but he was a very private person. And that when he was not on set, he was off with his family and you never saw him. He was like, he was not one of those stars that was always out and about trying to get his picture taken.
Yep.
And a lot of people respected him. Who else? Mary Philbin plays Christine Dye. According to the film's cameraman, Charles Van Inger, one of Lon Chaney's most trusted associates, Mary Philbin's reaction to the unmasked Phantom, as you said, was real. She had no idea what he would look like until that exact moment.
Yeah. Yeah, which is great.
Thanks, Lon.
You know, which to me, well, we'll get to it when we get the keys. Yeah.
Sure. The guy that played Raul is Norman Carey. All I have is that he's also in Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is another one of those famous Lon Chaney movie monsters. Also very empathic, or very sympathetic, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Arthur Edmund Carew played Ledoux. He was in Dr. X and Mystery of the Wax Museum, which was the original movie that House of Wax was a remake of, which we covered on, I think, our second season. Arthur was tormented by a stroke that hampered his acting career. He was found dead in his car in Santa Monica in a Santa Monica auto garage of an apparent suicide, gunshot to the head. So Ledoux killed himself. And then lastly, Simon Bouquet was played by Gibson Goland. He's the only actor to appear in separate death scenes filmed by Lon Chaney and Lon Chaney Jr. He played Simon Bouquet in Phantom of the Opera and later made an appearance as a villager in The Wolfman.
Oh, didn't know that.
So he did a talkie himself. Yeah. So that's a little bit on the cast. They're all dead. I think, you know what? They are. But the last person from this film to die was in 2014. Her name was Carla Lemley.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Niece of producer Carl Lemley, who played a small role as a prima ballerina in the film when she was around 15 years old.
Excellent.
So she old.
That's good.
Yeah. She would have been over 110, if that's true.
Correct. If she only died in 25 or whatever.
Oh, man. Maybe she wasn't 15 years old. She was probably younger.
Probably.
Anyway, she died in 2014. So that's what I have there. As far as awards, it was the 1998 winner of the National Film Registry Award, which we always talk about. It was selected by the Library of Congress for preservation for being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. So even though it was in the public domain, it still got that award.
Mm-hmm.
However, in 1925, it won the Photoplay Award for Best Pictures of the Month, I guess, magazine pictures, maybe. Best Performance of the Month. And Lon Chaney also won for Actor. I don't know what that means. Do you? Photoplay Awards?
No, I don't. Maybe they were pre-Oscars? Because I don't think the Oscars were around in 25.
No, but I think Photoplay was a magazine, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, regardless of all that, it is on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list. I completely agree with this, and I have no issue with that at all.
And you can find, like I said, you can find different versions. The one version I watched, every time it was in the Phantom's lair or you saw his shadow, because I like the fact that when, for the whole first half of the movie, anytime you see him, you just see his shadow on a wall talking to Christine or doing whatever. But all of those are tinted green in one version I saw. And then, of course, the Red Death scene is tinted red. But everything else is in the gray, typical black and white look, which I thought was interesting. I've got in my watch notes, the reveal of the Phantom is so scary he gets blurry. The camera gets blurry. Because the
it does. You can see it in this picture a little bit. Yeah.
And I think that's just because they don't have footage to fix it. They don't have anything else to replace it with, sort of thing. And I've got that, of course, the original ending was added 2 years later. The ending we see now was added 2 years later, or the next year. Wait, hold on. Let me look at my dates. It premiered.
Is this when they throw him in the river?
Yeah. It premiered January 7th, 1925 in L.A., but all of that original footage was lost in the fire. It was re-edited in a new version that was released in April of 2025, where they created the final scene with the angry mob killing Eric. So in the original release for test audiences, I guess, or whatever, he wasn't killed. So there's that.
How did it end?
Well, I'm sure it ended very similar to the novel and to the Weber version, where he releases Christine, lets her and Raoul go, and he just disappears into the catacombs of the opera.
Okay.
Never to return, or possibly for the sequel, Son of Phantom.
Well, I was going to say, isn't Lloyd Webber working on a sequel to the musical? I think he is.
It's not a sequel. It's a reimagining of the same story, told in an immersive environment. It just opened a few months ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I have a little bit of trivia before we move on to Keith. You've already mentioned that the makeup was kept secret, and that's there were no pictures released. However, I've got that Gregory Peck's earliest movie memory is of being so scared by the Phantom of the Opera at age 9 that his grandmother allowed him to sleep in the bed with her that night.
Wow.
That sounds like me.
Well, yeah.
I would have been that scared too. So, Keys.
Keys just for this one? Or are we doing keys for everything at the end? I think for this one.
Do you think we should wait and do them together?
No, I think we can.
We normally separate them.
We can separate them out. I do think vaudeville is a key because it influenced Chaney. I have Poe as a key, of course, because of Mask of the Red Death and the description of Prospero and the way he comes down the stairs during the masquerade. I had said
Sven. I have.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No,
I was just going to first say that we can always say the novel and the musical.
Oh, one yeah. As far as influences came after. Coming after, yeah.
So
the
novel, I'm not sure what year the novel was published.
I think in 10 or 12, 19,
okay.
10 or 12. Because Limley read it before, so yeah.
Right, right.
I mentioned already Svengali, you know, the story of a mentor who loves and is brutalizing his obsession to make them better. And it's usually a male for a female, of course, sort of thing. You said Weber's version. I have all of the initial versions, meaning the 25, both years in 25, and then it got another public release in September of 25. In 30... is when they re-edited it, like you said, with all the color added. So that's when they added the red tints, the green tints, and added some actual dialogue to it. They actually added audio to it in places in the 30s.
And version. Isn't one scene like completely colorized? I want to say it may be the Red Death scene.
Yeah.
There's one that's like completely colorized where it looks like a color film.
Correct. It's not, that's the one that's not washed in color. It actually is. He looks painted in red. You know, he's a guy wearing a red costume sort of thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The 1943, which was the Claude Rains version, where they first established the whole acid gag. The 1953 is when it became... No, 1953, just a trivia thing. It's when it became public domain. It's when Universal lost it.
Mm-hmm,
86 is when the musical premiered. Of course, Phantom, the Hammer version was before that. In 86. In 95 is when they did the musical version of the play. And then you had the Hammer one, which we're about to go to. So all those different...
Well, there was, in between that, there was that Dario Argento one I mentioned as well. And there was also another 80s version that had Robert Englund in it,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, you're right.
There have been tons and tons of adaptions of this.
And then there was...
I wonder if it's like...
I remember one that I associate with you, too, is Phantom of the Paradise. I remember when it came out, and it was
a big... I hate that movie.
I know, me too. But...
And that's Brian De Palma.
Yep. I've got... go ahead. You do something.
I've got... Well, I was going to say, I mentioned It,
which is
a monster that's in the sewers.
Yep.
You can't ignore that. As far as the Universal connection, we mentioned the sympathetic monster. So you could also say Frankenstein and Wolfman there. And even you even mentioned Creature from the Black Lagoon. I forgot that one.
I would even say The Fly, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because
he is, and he is very mad scientist like. He's just mad musician.
Yeah, and in the Cronenberg version of The Fly, he wants her to change. He wants her to be different, to be like him, to be better. So it's kind of pseudo similar to the key of Eric.
So. Do you think it's more The Fly original or The Fly Cronenberg?
Probably The Fly Cronenberg. The mad scientist gag does work, similar to Frankenstein and The Phantom for The Fly, the original Fly. So, yeah.
I think we're stretching it, though.
Yeah, that's a little bit.
I'm going to say Night of the Living Dead because of it losing its copyright.
Oh, that's great. That's a good one.
You know, this and there's other films out there I can't think off the top of my head, but two of the more famous horror movies that lost their copyright would be this and Night of the Living Dead, I would think.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
That are two of the most influential horror movies, let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
That lost their copyrights.
And now Mickey
Mouse. I've got another one.
So, yeah.
Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, he's public domain now.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me that Disney owned the rights or something.
No, God, no. Oh, yeah.
I have one that may contradict something you said earlier in that you were saying it went on to influence the cinema of Germany. What is it called?
Expressionism.
That kind of cinema? Expressionism, like Nosferatu. Nosferatu came out in 1922, 3 years before this movie. So it technically influenced this when you see that shadow work.
Okay, yeah, that was So that's that key is it was influenced by sort of German expressionism. Yeah,
I think the Germans did it first.
Yeah,
Americans,
of course.
On.
Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, all that.
Yeah. Right. Which it, I think Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is. In my research as a kid, not as an adult, was like the first horror movie ever made.
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe. That and that hexagon thing, whatever, the witch one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Anyway. There's several. They're on our list.
I have two other keys. One is Alien because of the face reveal. They kept it a secret from everybody, even people on the set and everything else. So when the chest buster happened and when the face mask reveal happens, it's both, you get the genuine reactions. And there's other, I'm sure there are other movies like that where they kept things from the cast members, so to speak. But just that one. And then the other one I had is a tribute to you too, which is Fibes, Dr. Fibes.
Yes, that's great. I didn't think about
that. I mean, down to the organ, the skull face, the brings the girl to his lair, and then even down to the I'm on a boat with a girl sailing into the Egyptian sunset or whatever, you know, the afterlife or whatever. So
yeah, that is very Phantom-esque.
Yeah,
for sure.
Lots of Phantom inspiration. Wow. From Fibes.
Okay. Well, we'll give a summary, I guess, of both films when we get to the end, but I think we can say it's safe to move on to
sure.
our second film, which would be the 1962 version, not the 43 version, which came in between with Claude Rains. This one is the Hammer version. Hammer was known for redoing Universal Monster movies, starting with Frankenstein. They did Dracula. They did The Mummy. And then they did Curse of the Werewolf maybe came out before this, but I can't remember. But Werewolf and Phantom shortly followed those three biggies. And this one stars Herbert Lom. Speaking of The Fly, isn't he in the Cronenberg version? I think he is. Let me give you a quick synopsis here. Hang on. Get my notes so you people know what we're talking
about. Yeah, because it's different.
It is different. In this one, composer Lord Ambrose Darcy and his backer Harry Hunter struggle to find a replacement for the female lead in their new opera after she quits in the wake of a gruesome murder. That's how this movie starts, by the way, with gruesome murder.
Oh, yeah.
Chamber. When a new prospect, the nubile Christine Charles, disappears, Harry cautiously investigates. Meanwhile, a mysterious masked man who is eerily familiar with the opera holds Christine captive and offers to groom her to play the part. What is your... I'm very interested in what your connection is with this film, because I've always known that you liked this film.
Yeah. I saw this on Shock Theater back in the day, at least once or twice. I thought it did stuff in some cases it did stuff better than the original, I thought. In other ways, I don't think it did, especially near the ending and everything else. But I also like the fact that, to me, it was scarier. The 25 version is creepy and has suspense and stuff, especially with the shadow and all this stuff. But it's still a silent movie. You kind of have to read along with it. You go with it. But the big scare in it is the face reveal. But once it's revealed, the rest of it just kind of is. I'm not scared for Raoul and the guy in the hot room. I'm not scared for them drowning. I don't have any connection to them. Sort of thing. I thought the Herbert Lom one personified Eric, even though his name is not Eric anymore, a lot better and gave him much more of a tragic hero kind of story. I also like the fact that they treat it almost like a mystery. We're following along with this guy trying to figure out who this professor guy is and what's happening and where did he go and what was his story. And I like that mystery component to it. Also, the opera scenes in it are there, but they're not horrifically over the top like in the Claude Rains version and in the musical, quite frankly. They kind of do too much of the opera.
But they're a little under, too. It looks very low budget.
It does. And it also, where it fails, I think, is I don't like the fact that they change every damn name in it. I don't like the fact that they have to set it in America instead of in France or in even London, even.
It set in America?
Well, they all have American names except for Lord Darcy. But even he...
I thought it was in England.
And nobody has a British. Nobody has a British accent. I mean, really.
I think they say England at one point, though. I'm pretty sure.
They might.
Which I found odd, too, because I'm like, it's supposed to be in France. Why is it in England?
Yeah.
Oh, because all the actors are English. That's why.
Yeah.
Which may be also why they changed the names. It could also be, and sorry for me interrupting.
No.
It also could be the whole Universal connection. Remember, Universal was very adamant about holding their properties close.
Yeah.
But Hammer was like having to change the titles and having to change the names and things, remember?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that had something to do with it as well. I don't know.
I think this has a really good quote, Frank, Bob, Tom, whoever, Raoul, even though he's not Raoul, I thought he was a really good actor.
Harry.
Yeah, Harry.
It's not Tom, Dick, or it's Harry.
It's Harry. I thought Darcy was a great villain, although one of the bad things about it is that, you know, because we're now treating the Phantom as our kind of tragic hero, we have to have another bad guy. So they create this Darcy character who's a lecherous, egomaniacal thief, you know, a horrible person. And I thought Gough did a really
I am reading now that it is pronounced Guff.
Guff. Okay, great. Guff.
We have never been able to pronounce his name ever since Batman in 1989.
But I think he did a great job being this villain and being the bad guy. I love the art direction of this, even though parts of it look cheap. I like the scares in it. I like the whole ripping down the one flat and the body comes swinging right towards her. That was a good scare. I like him being up in
it. It didn't seem very logical, though. I was like, why is his hand doing that?
Yeah. I liked
him. Maybe if he had a knife in it, like Sparrow, Jack Sparrow.
I liked him being up in the in box five and watching her sing and watching the finale and all that. I did like I love his lair with the water and the way they did all of that and the way the organ is. And it's, to me, so typical in the fact that we couldn't hear it in the 25 version. They don't do it in the 43 version. But in this version, they actually use Toccato and Fugue, which is a great, you know, organ scary song. It's one of the classic organ scary songs.
Very Halloween.
Yeah, yeah. I like the fact that we're kind of thrown in from the very beginning. The Phantom is already there and terrorizing. And then we get this flashback story of how it happened to begin with, which I thought was a really cool structure to it. I don't like the way this movie ends. It ends very abruptly. It seems like there's stuff missing at the end. And I went back and tried to do some research on it and found out that Tony Hines, was the actual...
He's a very classic Hammer producer, isn't he?
The writer. He was the writer.
A writer,
but yeah. This was his first screenplay, and he wrote it under the name of John Elder. And...
Yes.
And so this was his first screenplay, but it seems like there were scenes missing. Like...
It wasn't his first. He did Horror of Dracula and Curse of Frankenstein as well.
Before this? Because I saw two different sources that said that this was his first screenplay.
I can double check, but I have it in my notes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm wrong about that. Either him or Terrence Fisher or somebody, the end of this just seems really abrupt. He says, you know, give me 1 week. Just give me 1 week with Christine and she'll be amazing. And then suddenly we cut and it's opening night and Darcy comes running into the theater, goes into one room where the Phantom is waiting for him. He unmasks the Phantom. We don't see it. He goes running out. We never hear from him again. We suddenly cut to the finale, and she is singing this incredibly great song of I Will Always Hear Your Voice, which works not only for her singing to the Phantom, but also Joan singing to God. So it works really cool, and it was a neat little scene. But then the hunchback shows up and he jumps on the chandelier and the Phantom has to save her and he dies and then we're done. And I went, what the hell? How did we go to this at the very end so fast? Sort of thing.
Okay, you're right. It was his first screenplay, but he produced those movies. That's why I thought he was producer when you said that.
Well, that makes
sense. That's where the connection is.
Okay.
But I had him down for that. And I was like, there's a reason. And that's why. As far as background, though, since we're there already, we should mention that Terrence Fisher directed this.
Oh, yeah.
He is one of two major Hammer film directors, the other being, what's his name? I'm not going to be able to think of it right now. Anyway, Terrence, we have done several of his movies, including Horror of Dracula, The Mummy, The Devil Rides Out, just to name three.
Yeah.
He directed 29 films for Hammer, more than anyone else.
Wow.
Yeah. He was an extremely underrated director since all the legendary movies he directed are mostly given full credit to Hammer films and or the actors starred, like Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, neither of whom are in this one, but they are very closely associated with Hammer films. You mentioned Anthony Hines. I've got that due to budgetary constraints, Hammer couldn't afford to hire a screenwriter for Curse of the Werewolf. Consequently, Hines stepped in to turn out a workable script under the pseudonym John Elder. Huh. He continued to use this alias for his many writing credits during the remainders of the 60s and 70s. So I guess he couldn't be producer and writer, so that's why he used a pseudonym? I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know what the rules are for British filmmaking.
Right.
I have no idea why. The son and co-founder of Hammer Films, Will Hammer, who took over his father's share of the business when the latter died, was also, I guess, one of the contributors to the script.
Mm-hmm.
And Gaston Leroux, of course, would be a contributor because it's his main property.
Of course.
But that's all I have as far as that. I do have that it flopped on its release, and director Terrence Fisher fell out of favor with Hammer Studios with this film, for whom he was not given another one until 1964, 2 years later. Two whole years.
Yeah.
Right. But back then they were churning them out. So.
Well, it's like I said, I think, part of it is that whole last, 15 minutes. It's thrown together really fast, and we get this climax that's kind of unsatisfying. Victor Petrie does save Christine and sacrifice himself, but nobody really gets punished. Darcy doesn't get punished. We don't see what happens to the hunchback. We don't see what happens to the opera house or anything. I was just like, okay, we're done. Go home.
It's a terrible ending.
Look at the mask laying here.
Yeah. The other director that directed almost as many for Hammer was Freddie Francis.
Freddie Francis was a
big director.
It. Yep.
Yeah. I could not think of his name. Back to what we were talking about as far as connections is when I first started culling a list for us to do, podcast episodes from, I always paired the original with the 1943 Claude Rains.
Yeah.
Because everywhere I went, those were the top two rated, whether it be IMDb, whether it be Rotten Tomatoes or whatever, because Claude Rains, I guess, was a superstar. And it wasn't until a few years into doing the podcast that you kept talking about the 1962 version of Phantom of the Opera. So that's why we're doing it today instead of the Claude Rains version. Though people like the Claude Rains, even though you don't.
Yeah.
They really do.
I don't know why, really. It has a lot not good about it, much more so than this one. I guess it's great if you... To me, this one is more inspired by the story and inspired by the 25, even though it's the hunchback doing it, not Phantom, but the whole reed in the water thing where he sneaks up behind Raoul and then tries to attack him. That's not in the Claude Rains version because Claude's not going to do that.
He also has an Igor-like sidekick.
Very
Frankenstein-ish.
That's not the best.
He's referred to as a dwarf in some of my notes, and I'm like, he wasn't a dwarf, was he? I don't think
he
was.
No, they keep calling him a dwarf.
Kind of hunched over.
Yeah. To me, he's a hunchback. He's not a dwarf.
Right.
But it's – I don't know. That's another of the negatives of this one is adding this whole – I guess because they wanted – Professor Petrie to be such a sympathetic character and taking his vengeance on Darcy that they needed somebody else to do the bad stuff. So we have to have the hunchback kill the rat catcher, and we have to have the hunchback kidnap her, and we have to have the hunchback attack people sort of thing. And I think Eric could have still done that and been a very conflicted sort of hero. So
right, or villain. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they do try to make him a hero, especially with the ending when he swings in and dies in place of her.
Yes. And it's very, a key to me is there's a Hammer there where, isn't that how Dracula dies? The chandelier falls on him?
at the end. It's one of the hammers does that. It may be
brides. There's been like eight.
It may be brides or one of those, but I've got it in my, that's a key for me is at the end of that one, Christopher Lee dies with a chandelier falling on him sort of thing.
I don't remember which one it is, but that's because there's so many of them.
Yeah. So
chandelier.
Yep.
I'll put that in there.
Put that in.
See if I can find it. I'll go into cast really quickly because I think the cast is very strong in this movie, despite its flaws. The Phantom, of course, is played by Herbert Lom. His other name is Professor Petrie, as you mentioned.
Yep.
We know him from The Dead Zone, which is a Cronenberg movie. We know him as Dreyfus in the Pink Panther movies. And we last saw him a few seasons back when we did a double feature with Mysterious Island and some other movie. I can't remember what the other movie was we did.
I don't either.
Remember, we did something in Mysterious Island.
Yeah.
Well, oh, my God. We are so old.
Yeah, we are. I can't remember what we did with that one. Yeah. But
Anyway, he did play Captain Nemo in Mysterious Island. Mm-hmm. When asked about his various roles in low-budget movies, he said it felt like it was better to be miscast than to not be cast at all. Which is very good advice for an actor.
Yep.
At one point, Christopher Lee was seriously considered for this. And I think it would have done better probably had he been in it. Not because he is better, just because he is more well-known. Heather Sears plays.
Speaking of casting, I have a trivia thing that kind of ties in with that. And you might want, I'm surprised you may have it in your notes or whatever, but Tony Hines originally wrote the entire screenplay for Cary Grant.
Oh, I do have that in my notes.
He wanted Cary Grant somewhere to play Professor Petrie. And that's kind of why he's a nicer villain, is because Cary Grant would be playing his first villain character.
Yeah, I don't know if I put that in there or not, but I did read that.
Yep.
Oh, wait, here it is. I put it in the wrong place.
Yeah, so that's kind of...
No, I've got that he was written not as the Phantom, but as the Harry Hunter character.
Really? I had him as the Phantom in my notes, but either way, that works.
Okay, that's why I had not got to it yet, because I haven't got to that character yet.
Okay, that may
so
be true.
So I will go there.
Okay.
Edward De Souza plays Harry Hunter in this, and according to producer Anthony Hine in Wayne Kinsey's book, Hammer, The Brace Studio Years, Cary Grant was originally slated not for the role of the Phantom, as commonly assumed, but for the romantic lead eventually played by Edward De Souza. The film was written for Cary Grant, who wanted to do a horror picture. The Phantom's character was rewritten as a more tragic figure, with the dwarf played here by Ian Wilson doing the actual violence to suit Grant's image. Grant declined the part, possibly unhappy with the watered-down character, and it went to Lom.
See? They end up starting about the hero guy, but they end up ending with the Phantom. And so,
I know. It doesn't make sense.
Of course, so we assume it's Eric's character.
So it doesn't make sense. And I also have always confused Cary Grant with Gregory Peck. And I was just talking about Gregory Peck being scared as a kid.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about Cary Grant.
Yeah.
That's weird.
So
I have the two things as well. But I think that the one that I mentioned first is probably true, since it was documented in a book that it was originally the romantic lead. That makes more sense to me than him playing the Phantom.
But I think he would have dwarfed Lom and even Darcy almost. It would have been interesting
in
to
stature.
See him and Guff opposite each other, but I just think that might have been an ill pairing, for lack of a better word, you know?
Yeah. Very strange. A lot of conflicting information. Thurley Walters played Latimer.
Yep.
And most prominent, in my opinion, is Michael Guff, who plays Darcy.
Yep.
He is fantastic in everything he does.
Yep.
He's in a ton of horror movies. He plays a great prick.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
He is a total ass. Oh, yeah. I've got his surname is pronounced in the same way as Goff. So it's Goff.
Okay, Goff. And you're all sacked. Okay. Everyone's sacked. Everyone leave. I'm firing everyone.
What's that from?
That's what he says. And he goes, you know, because he fires.
Oh, yeah.
He sacks the conductor. And then the whole orchestra starts to leave. And he goes, you're all sacked.
Yes. Oh, God. He's such a twit.
Yeah.
We knew him. Well, we knew him. Of course, we watched Hammer films when we were kids.
Yeah.
But we really knew him as adults when he came into Tim Burton's hand playing Alfred as in the Batman movies of the late 80s with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. He's a great Alfred. He's probably my favorite Alfred, even better than Michael Caine, I think. We last saw him in Sleepy Hollow. He was in that as well, which is a Tim Burton movie.
Yep, another Tim Burton movie.
Ironically, I found out, and I may have said this when we did Sleepy Hollow, he was very close friends with Alan Napier, who played Alfred on the television series Batman, and I believe was also a British actor.
I'm sure.
Yeah. He may have been American, but he was around back in the day. And then I have that Harold Goodwin played Bill. He was also in Quatermass in the Pit and Die, Monster, Die. Mm-hmm. Die, Monster, Die is a very unique take on The Color of Outer Space. And then Quatermass in the Pit. Is that the one we did?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it is. Yeah. So we've seen him before. And then nothing else. Bill played, or Martin Miller played Rossi, the dwarf. No awards. And is not on the list of 1,001 movies you must see before you die.
It's still 25 would be my favorite. This would be my second. I'm not a big fan of the Claude Rains, and I'm not a, of course, Phantom of the Paradise. And I haven't seen the Robert Englund one, but I can't imagine it being. Oh.
It's the Phantom calling.
Let me. Let them in to do their thing. We'll cut there. If I remember correctly, we'll cut there. But I don't remember. I haven't watched the Robert Englund one, so I can't really comment on whether it's good or not. But I can't imagine it being better than this. This was vengeance and cool story and acid burns and singing Toccato and Fugue.
Definitely for a kid movie, there's more action in it, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, swinging from the rafters and falling down, ripping sails, dead bodies hanging.
Yeah. I think the scares are better. The rat catcher scene is scary. I'm going to open my drapes after my lovely date and suddenly there's a hunchback hanging out my window is scary. So, yeah.
I have one trivia. It says the music Herbert Lom plays as the Phantom is the same music he played as Nemo in Mysterious Island. Did he do Bach in Mysterious Island?
Yeah, Toccato and Fugue,
Okay, I figured he did.
That makes sense.
Keys?
My first key kind of leads to a trivia bit, too. Halloween, the mask in this, I love the mask in this Phantom. It looks like it's scary. And, you know, the 25 version, the mask kind of looks kind of goofy. The Andrew Lloyd Webber version, the mask looks romantic. That's what he wanted. He wanted it to be kind of there, but also have a romance sort of beauty to it. This one is scary. It's got only one eye, and it looks all stiff, and it looks
right there.
It's interesting. I saw an interview thing where they were talking about, it was either somebody from Hammer who said, "What did you do for the mask? Because it really looks like you took a dishcloth and put it in concrete." And he goes, "Yeah, I took a dishcloth and I put it in a hard firming agent to make the mask." Yeah.
You can see it breathe though sometimes.
Yeah, where his lips are.
He's breathing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he hardened the edges and hardened around the eyes and everything. And I say Halloween, the John Carpenter Halloween, just because the way the mask is around the eyes and it's kind of pulled away and the starkness of the mask reminds me of Halloween a lot.
So, yeah, I could see that. I honestly don't have a lot of keys because most of my keys we've already done for the first movie.
Yeah.
Including Frankenstein, which I in the first one said it was because he was a sympathetic monster. In this one, I say it's because he has a sidekick like Igor.
I've got that too. I've got Igor. It's Frankenstein for this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned Halloween, and I'm going to go Freddy Krueger because I think the makeup looks like Freddy Krueger. It looks very pizza face, like he's got scars.
Makeup-wise, yes. I would totally agree with that. Yes.
So there's a little influence there to Kevin Yeager, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
Makeup artist for Freddy Krueger. Any other keys?
No, I don't have any other ones.
They're the same property, so they're going to have the same keys virtually.
Yeah, and I would not be surprised if there is another version of this in our future before we even die. People keep coming back to this story of a cursed mentor who lives underneath the opera house or the theater house.
Yeah. And when we do another double feature in 5 years, we'll do the Claude Rains version and the Dario Argento version.
There you go. We'll do those two. Yeah. But that's what Tim and I think. What do all of you guys out there think? Which version did you watch? Which versions do you like or dislike or whatever? How does this compare to Andrew Lloyd Webber's, musical, which swept the entire world and is still coming back for a kind of reimagining sort of thing? The tragic tale of Eric and Christine and Raoul. But we'd love to know. Let us know down below if you like what you heard today or didn't like what you do. Let us know too. We'd love to hear from you guys. We always do. We do have a Patreon. If you feel like you want to support our podcast, we would love to have you do that and become a member. We have lots of free stuff there, but also some tiers which help us defray costs of like equipment and editing and all of that.
And I am horrible at mentioning it, but when we get new members in our Patreon group, but we do have a new member named Eden. I'd like to mention.
Yay.
Just mention her.
Hey, Eden. Mm-hmm. Welcome aboard. We're glad to have you supporting us and being with us. Tim has novels and all kinds of stuff out there you guys need to look up because he's a writer and does some great work and everything else. And until next week, Tim.
Pseudonymous.
Where do we go next week? Go back to Funland, or are we still scared?
Next week, we're going back into outer space.
Yay, good.
I'm fairly certain.
As we should. Yeah. Because that's a good place to be, away from all the castles and the scary and the phantom operas and stuff.
And the Toccata and Fugue.
Toccata and Fugue. Let's end with that, shall we? I think I will.
Okay.
See you next time.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. You need to do that.